Hi everyone, and welcome to the Norfolk Early Years Podcast Let's Talk series, a show that helps early years practitioners and professionals understand more about effectively supporting children's speech, language and communication development in the early years. I'm Ashley Cater.
And I'm Jo Patterson.
And we are Early Years Communication and Language Development Officers within Norfolk County Council's Early Years team. And today we are privileged to be joined by the wonderful Anne O'Connor, independent consultant, trainer, author and co-founder of Primed for Life, a venture which advocates for a wider understanding of the body as a child's first place of learning. In today's episode, we are going to be uncovering the hidden links between children's physical development and their communication development, whilst exploring how practitioners can ensure that they are offering the best opportunities for physical play to their children. So, without further ado, let's talk physical development. Hi Anne, thanks for joining us for our first episode today. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Very well. And you?
Good. I'm very well, thank you. If it's okay with you, we're going to jump straight into our conversation for today, and we're going to start at the very beginning with a little bit of background about yourself. So, to quote your book, Understanding Physical Development in the Early Years, Linking Bodies and Minds, it says, "Today's children may find their instinctive biological drive for movement overruled by adults, teachers, learning environments, programs and policies, actively missing out on the key fundamental developments for mind and body that can prime them for life." So with this in mind, Anne, what is the mission that you're on as an early year specialist, and how did you end up here?
Perhaps it's worth saying, first of all, that I've been around a very long time. I qualified as a teacher way back last century in 1979. And I always knew I wanted to be a teacher, right from first meeting my first reception teacher, the lovely Miss Turner, who had a beehive, which is a hairdo for those that won't remember, back in the 60s. And she wore beautiful swishy skirts. There was something so wonderfully sensory about my first experiences in that reception class with the chalk and the crayons and the paper and the scissors and all these lovely things that I couldn't wait to get my hands on. And I also knew that I wanted to emulate that safe, warm, encouraging and creative environment that I'd known right from the beginning of my early experience of school. It wasn't always like that, but my reception class was. So I trained as a teacher, and I was trained in what was called early years, which back then was from 3-year-olds to, wait for it, eight, all the way up to eight. And then I worked over 24 years, mostly in infant schools, but also primary schools in the East End of London. I did the management thing. I had two deputy headships and an extended period as an acting head. And then I decided to jump off that ladder as the national curriculum took hold, and I felt increasingly uncomfortable about the direction that education was going in. So I followed my heart and I went to teach a nursery class in a primary school on the Isle of Dogs, still in the East End. And then I had the good fortune to be asked to create one of the first all through early years units. So this is even before the foundation stage. So we couldn't even call them foundation stage units then. But actually the important thing about this was it was all through, where nursery and reception were completely and totally integrated. Now, during this time, I also became an adopted parent to a child with a trauma history and a whole alphabet of invisible disabilities. And eventually, I felt it was too much of a struggle for me juggling his needs and a senior leadership role. So I took the big decision to begin working from home, building up my skills as a consultant, trainer and a writer for Nursery World and other publications, a lot of which I could do that in the midnight hours. But it also kept me connected to the world of early years, about which I became even more passionate, as my son taught me so much about the importance of a child's earliest experiences, mostly because of what he had missed out on. So then you can fast forward a few years, and I had the good fortune to meet Anna Daly, with whom I set up Primed for Life, when we discovered a mutual passion and curiosity about the way children's bodies often get left out of the equation when we're talking about progress and learning and development, as though physical development is something that just happens. And if you take the physical development learning goal seriously, it would seem that all physical development is about is whether they can make their own way to the toilet, holding a pair of scissors safely without bumping into anyone. The incredible way the body and the brain work together to achieve a child's fullest potential. And this is right from day one. Actually, no, it's from pre-birth. So that's how Prime for Life was born. And we've been privileged to help raise awareness of the importance of physical development as perhaps, we like to say, the most prime of all the prime areas because of the way it is essential for both emotional health and for communication and language development. But it does feel like it's an ongoing struggle to fight for that awareness. Do we have time for a little story here? Anna and I were involved in a project where we're visiting nurseries. And a wonderful little movement play scenario was developing with a group of children where we were totally following their lead, but there was this whole range of learning and creativity and developmental movement happening right up next to a door, actually, when all of a sudden there was this, children, and the staff suddenly called all the children to attention and told them to come away from the door so that they could go and line up at the door to go into another room for their movement session. And this is not to blame the staff, okay? They were doing it with the best of intentions. This was part of their program day. It was part of their structure. But the irony was not lost on us that so often we have to interfere with the learning in order to look like we're doing our jobs properly. You know, when in fact the learning was taking place there, the movement was happening there, you know, right in front of us in an awkward spot, yes. And actually what the children, dare I say, what the children got from being interrupted, being made to line up, and these were three-year-olds, going into a different room and then doing something to nursery rhymes, perhaps was nothing as powerful, like as powerful as what they were doing when we were playing together. And that's why it feels so important to us. And I think, you know, we're thinking there particularly about the work that Julie Fisher's been doing, interacting or interfering, yeah, which really kind of, you know, we've got a lot of connection with that. So that's our mission, really, to skill everyone up so that they can fight for children's right to allow their brains and their bodies to work together. And that so much of what practitioners do or would do instinctively when they really know their children, those things are way more valid and valuable than many of the programs that people end up telling them they have to buy into.
That sounds like an extremely admirable mission that you're on, Anne.
Well, you know, it's turned my hair grey, but, you know, it feels worthwhile. And it's fun along the way, I have to say, you know.
Absolutely.
What other job gives you the opportunity to play as much as ours does? So.
Definitely. Thank you so much for that, Anne. It was really interesting to hear about, you know, your experiences, where you started from, and your passion for physical development's really just come through there. So if we can take a bit of a focus on physical development, can you just explain exactly what we mean when we say physical development and help us to understand what's happening in that child's brain when they engage in that physical play?
Well, have you got all day? Okay. Trying to capture that in a snapshot. I suppose it's fair to say that physical development probably includes everything you think it includes. And when we ask people, we usually hear things like muscles and joints and health and exercise and gross and fine motor skills and nutrition. But then multiply it, maybe to include a million other things like sensory development and the nervous system. And then we can throw in words like interoception and proprioception and the vestibular system, sensory integration, and stuff that sounds very sciencey and a bit scary, perhaps. So maybe it would be better if we had a better word for it, maybe something like neurophysiological development. Though I'm not even sure if that's the right term here, because I'm not a brain scientist. I wouldn't even call myself any kind of a scientist. But actually, that is exactly what we and all of us who work with babies and young children, that's what we are. We are in the business of growing children's brains and their bodies. So actually having a little bit of neuroscience under our belts gives us the words and the signs to be able to advocate for our children. And that is all part of physical development. because typically the brain needs the body and the body needs the brain for them to grow to the best of the child's capability. And this might be in ways that we understand as typical development, or it might even be atypical, in which case it's even more important that we understand things like sensory integration. So we can understand why some children might be sensitive to things like touch or sound, and why some children can't seem to get enough sensory sensation. So they'll go seeking sensations in ways that might get them into trouble and that often get classified as challenging behavior. So the more we understand this stuff, the better we are able to understand our children and our partners and our friends and our work colleagues. And you know what? We actually understand ourselves better too. So to unpick some of those things very simplistically, gross motor skills are the big motor movements that we do involving major parts or maybe even all of our bodies. And here's the thing, these typically need to come first before the fine motor skills. So if you take handwriting, for example, that's a fine motor skill. But without lots of experience of moving and feeling control of our trunk, both the front and the back, so that's our upper body, and in particular our shoulder and the whole of our arms, and all of that takes a good few years of movement experience, and especially we need playful, self-motivated experience, like climbing, swinging, hanging, throwing, carrying, pushing, dragging, sweeping, all of that needs to be taking place whilst all the fine bones and the joints and the tendons in those little hands and fingers and wrists are taking their own time to develop. For the fine motor skills to develop well and efficiently so that then handwriting and all those other fine motor skills can develop with ease and confidence. So, you know, the watchword is gross motor skills before fine motor skills. Yeah. And then filling in the gaps. If we're seeing children who we perhaps think should have acquired all of those gross motor skills and are ready for handwriting and fine motor skills, and then actually looking at them, being able to observe their play and discovering that, in fact, there are some gaps there. But having said all of that, it is important to stress, too, that physical development isn't just something that happens on the big stuff out in the playground or outdoors. Children are and should be constantly on the move. And a lot of really important developmental movement play can happen indoors and as part of your continuous provision and not just in a programmed session for it. And the same is true of the other word I threw in before, the vestibular system, which is a weird word for the sensory system that is responsible for all our balance and ultimately our ability to be still. It's linked to our vision and it's connected to our inner ear. And it's hugely important, and I could take a whole day just to bang on about that one, but it's something that when it's working, we take it for granted and we don't really know it's there. And when it's not, we really do know about it. So if you've ever had vertigo or been travel sick, then it's been your vestibular system that's been out of whack. And if we had another day to talk about the link between the vestibular system and emotional well-being, and actually the part it plays in feeling grounded and secure. And, you know, we use the word, I'm having a wobble, meaning I'm not feeling quite right. That's directly linked to the way our vestibular system and our sense of balance and being secure on the ground is linked to our emotional and personal sense of ourselves.
If we imagine that I'm 2 or 3 years old, for example, and I'm doing lots of play in my setting that's developing my gross motor skills and then my fine motor skills, and it's stimulating my vestibular system. How in turn are all of those activities simultaneously supporting my speech and language development?
Okay. So the first thing is to be aware that for speech articulation, of course, there's a difference between, you know, the two aspects of communications, speech and language. But in terms of speech, we need all of these muscles and tiny little things, movements, to be well integrated enough to be able to articulate speech. So there's movement going on there. And that movement and the integration of that movement is also linked to the brain in the way that the brain can manage to kind of traffic control all these different things that are going on in our bodies at the same time. That's very simplistic, but you know, it's one aspect. There's also another few theories about this as well. So if I say, put yourself on a roller coaster, whether or not you like it, what's likely to happen when you come down? You know, the big one.
If it's me, I'd be screaming my head off.
Joe, do you enjoy them?
I don't.
Can you remember enjoying them?
We're not the best people to take to a theme park, are we, really, between us?
That's fine. That's fine. Because actually, the reality is that whether or not you're scared of them, you're probably still going to scream. And one of you might be screaming in distress. But actually, the majority of people who choose to go on roller coasters will be screaming with joy and exhilaration, and not deliberately. They don't go on and go, I'm going to scream. That scream comes out. That's the whole point. You slide down a slide, you go, wee! It would seem that our vestibular system is being very stimulated by those actions. And that seems to be what makes us involuntarily make sounds as well. To have the urge to vocalize, even though it's a drive, you know, we're not deliberately thinking about it. The urge to do it is there. So quite a few years ago now, Dr. A. Jean Ayres, who is somebody I would definitely recommend you reading if you're interested to find out more about sensory integration, she suggested that it might be the case that children who haven't, for whatever reason, had enough vestibular experience in their earliest years might not have that same stimulation to vocalize. And that's actually starting off with babbling as a baby. Now, it's just a theory, but it often gets noted by speech therapists that with some of their children, their speech and language increases if they include vestibular activities into their sessions, like swinging on a swing first. And OTs, occupational therapists, who are working with children with balance issues, have often found that speech and language have improved when the child's balance improves. So there's definitely something in there to take note of, isn't there?
That's really interesting. Do you think that taking everything that you've said into account, it's important for our practitioners to be offering opportunities for vestibular stimulation as early as possible?
Well, how about if I say that the likelihood that in every baby room, these things are going on from the minute a parent hands over a baby who's perhaps a little distressed, and that practitioner is jiggling the baby up and down and rocking them slightly to soothe and comfort them. That's vestibular stimulation. That's what's so wonderful about the way adults are instinctively driven to help children develop their sensory systems. And that's one of the most important ways that that happens. We rock and sway with babies to soothe them. We jiggle them up and on our knees and bounce them up and down and even throw them up in the air. And that will be happening in baby rooms too. You know, you don't need the equipment. You don't need the activity. It doesn't need to be in a lesson plan. You know, this is something that instinctively adults have the urge to do that. And I think what we need to do there is to be able to, first of all, recognize that, give validation for it. You know, a baby room in general is a wonderfully stimulating place for the vestibular system. You know, whether or not you've got any fancy equipment, you know, it will be. Because if you've got a practitioner's arms and that practitioner knows that child well enough to be able to think, actually, I think what they might like to do is to be hung upside down. No, I won't say hung upside down, but you know what I mean? The sort of games that you can play with babies and young children where you let them experience that wonderful tipping feeling or falling through your knees as Humpty Dumpty, all being done in a safe way with a practitioner who knows the child well enough to know this is what they're ready for. And actually is also, because it's really, really important at whatever age, because sometimes children will tell us, no, I didn't like that, don't do it again, stop. Sometimes they will say, stop, stop, and they mean do it again. We also know that one, don't we? But equally, we need to be able to read what a child is telling us with their body. You know, stiffening or tension or just not feeling comfortable, because some child might not feel confident enough to say, no, don't do that to the grown-up. But actually, we can read it in their bodies. And it's that connection that we have physically that means that we're able to do that. And then you've got all those wonderful shared experiences that will be supporting the vestibular system. And that will go on to include slides and, you know, making your own slides so they're just the right height for a child, wobble boards and gym balls that you can bounce on and swing back, playing row, row, row the boat, there's a whole raft of things that practitioners will be doing instinctively. And actually, if they just, you know, if you just take a little bit of time to think, what do I do during the day where I'm actually involved in swaying and rocking and bouncing and jiggling and all of that, and going, that is vestibular development. And look at me, I'm building that child's brain, you know, and don't let anybody diminish how important all of that playful stuff is.
Mm, absolutely. As you were talking, you were making me think about some of our non-verbal children that are in our settings. And I was particularly thinking about what you said about the roller coaster example and those opportunities for involuntary noises and screams and laughs. Would it be fair to say that those kind of activities are useful to encourage speech sounds from non-verbal children? Is there a link there at all that, you know, that play can be helpful for them to develop that sense of voice?
I think it's definitely worth remembering that if our learning environments are places for sitting still and not moving a great deal, then, you know, regardless of how much we offer, we're actually not providing the base level of movement that these children will need. And then if we recognise that some of our children aren't getting the natural base level anyway, you know, for whatever reason at home, and we need to be aware, I mean, we've got children coming into settings now who were COVID babies, who may not have been as exposed to toddler groups or, you know, soft play areas and all, just even being out as much as in general we would have hoped. So any kind of limitation on those natural instinctive movements is going to have a part to play. So then if you then find yourself in a learning environment that is very static and quite restrictive, you're completely missing out on the opportunity to fill in those gaps. So it's the free movement that children are getting and should be having in nursery environments and in reception classes too, that are actually allowing them to make decisions for themselves and to be able to join in and to be encouraged, because some children will not necessarily be seeking those activities and will need a little bit of encouragement to do that. So for some of them, it might be like going back to the babyhood of, you know, being rocked and playing Humpty Dumpty and those kinds of things. Matching their developmental stage rather than their chronological age, as it were. And then there will be some children who are desperately seeking it and will be going out of their way to get as much of that experience as they can. And if they're finding themselves sat cross-legged on the carpet for a very long time, their bodies and their brains together will be saying, you need to move, mate. And so they might set up their own rocking or their own swaying or their own spinning around on their bottom in that little space that they're allowed to sit on. So actually, you know, children will have that drive to do it for themselves. And it's about us recognizing, actually, this child is telling me it needs to move more. Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, physical development, we talk about it being the prime of the prime areas. There's lots of debate about that. Actually, there's none of them come first. But our explanation of it is, and again, I want to do something visual here, but basically thinking of they're not a list, 1, 2, 3. They're not a pyramid with something at the top. They're actually an inverted pyramid with physical development at the base, holding up emotional on the one hand and communication and language on the other. You know, it's the pinnacle.
That's an interesting way to think about it, though. That is a good visual. So like an upside down triangle with physical development at the bottom.
And if you take away the physical development, well, the other two will just go poof, you know.
Yeah. So they're very mutually supportive, aren't they? They're, like you said, very interlinked. You almost couldn't separate them in some aspects.
Mutually dependent. And that's the problem, is that if we don't give the recognition to one of them, we're actually impacting on the other two as well.
So, Anne, I have a daughter, Isla, who is coming up for 2 now. She'll be 2 in April. And I've really noticed that over the last couple of months, she has a real fascination with spinning. For example, she loves spinning around on her own, but she also enjoys spinning around on play equipment or just being spun around in our arms. And in addition to that, she also really loves hiding too. So hiding in things, behind things, under things, etc. There's a lot of hide and seek going on at our house at the moment. So I was wondering, developmentally, are there specific ages and stages where children tend to exhibit a preference for certain types of movement or play?
Yes. I mean, it's loose, obviously, in the way that all children's development is. You know, they don't all get up and walk on the same day. So, you know, all of this does take its own time scale. But yeah, definitely spinning. And that, I think you would know now why she's doing that spinning, you know.
I do.
What's going on in there. But also she's discovering it feels good. And we all, if we find a little movement that feels good, we like to repeat it. And we repeat it because of the feel-good payback that we get. And let's face it, the brain and the body are working together there to give us that feel-good payback in order for us to develop and refine that movement. Because if it's good for us, the body and the brain want us to do more of it so that we get better at it. Or so that, and it isn't always about getting better at something. Sometimes it's about embedding it. So a lot of that spinning stuff, we don't need to get better at spinning. What we do is that it gets embedded in the brain and the brain is going, yeah, okay, I'm getting enough of this stuff now to be able to kind of go, yeah, the vestibular system is developing. And we think certainly with the vestibular system, like a lot of things, up until at least the age of 7 before it's, you know, it's firmly embedded. So these things, they might rise to a height and they're obsessed with spinning, and then it might fade away, and then it might, you know, it might bob up again. And hiding, hiding is such a fun one, because that's where I get to talk about proprioception. Proprioception is another one of those lovely sensory things. It's a sensory system, and it's all about having a sense of our inner body. You know, what it's like having eyes on the inside and a whole set of maps. I think it's Jill Connell and Cheryl McCarthy refer to it as proprioception as our inner GPS, satellite, sat-nav, yeah? And they refer to the vestibular system as our inner spirit level. So, you know, both of those things, yeah. So proprioception really is something that has to be constantly being tested and stretched, because we are constantly stretching as babies. You know, what the cardboard box you could fit into easily last week, well, maybe next week, you don't fit into quite so easily because of that, you know, massive growth that's taking place all the time. And babies are learning about where they start and where they end. You know, I can fit into this space, I can't fit into this space. And it's proprioception ultimately as adults that enables us to walk through an open doorway without bumping into the doorframe.
Importantly.
Yes. Absolutely. It's what allows us to be able to sit down on a chair without first having to turn around and look at our bottoms as we're lowering it onto the chair seat. It's about how we can fasten the strings of an apron behind our back, or how we can, you know, plait our hair without seeing. You know, you might look in a mirror, but you can't see what's going on behind you. That's proprioception that enables us to do that. So if you think of a toddler, whose proprioception is still very much developing, they're walking, they kind of need to look at their hands to see what their hands are doing. They need to look at where their feet are going. Everything is a sort of a much more, I won't say slower, but it's a much more complex process as a toddler. But once proprioception is well enough developed, like vestibular, it's something you're not aware of. You're no longer aware of it. And that's when you get physical automatic mastery, which means that you can walk down the stairs without, and you know, carrying a bundle of washing and not have to look where your feet are going. So you can get in and out of a car.
Does that also contribute to your speech, language and communication development in the same way that the vestibular system does?
It's certainly in the mix. And it's in the mix because, and again, this is not an area totally of expertise on my part, but it's in the mix because your proprioception, this whole idea of physical mastery, to be able to move those muscles around your mouth involves physical automatic mastery, not having to think about it. But you know how you have to think about a word that's complicated or a new word in order to be able to move the right bits of your mouth and your tongue and all the rest of it. So it's in the mix, definitely. And it's about that. That's much, I think, you could parcel up in the whole sensory integration element of it, which is, you know, quite a big thing to talk about. And I don't feel totally qualified to give you chapter and verse on that one. It's fascinating. And I'm still learning a lot about that.
It's really interesting to hear what you say about the way the brain and the body, how it all melds together, doing stuff that we automatically just do. Whereas, yes, when you're a small child, you're having to really sort of think about it till you get into that mastery sense of doing those things. And it's really developing children's own sense of being, isn't it? So they're really understanding themselves, which I guess will then help with their speech and language, but it will also help with all those other areas of social development, emotional development. So it really sort of, like you said earlier on with your inverted pyramid, it really is sort of underpinning a lot of what children are learning and developing.
Yeah, and that's even before we talk about interoception, which is another sensory system. And that, you know, that actually enables us to understand our feelings and how what our body is telling us about how we feel and how well our body is functioning. That's a whole other system as well. Have I told you the story about the little boy for whom English wasn't his first language, who was very, very anxious arriving into nursery? So I observed this situation, and we were working with this nursery, but this happened to be something that happened alongside. And again, I'm kind of using the term continuous provision because it's about the daily life of a setting. It's not about a timetabled thing. And it's about, in this instance, about a practitioner being brave enough to try something that was a bit freaky, to be honest. So I was kind of holding her hand by the side of her while she attempted this. So this little lad arrived at nursery. I don't think he was quite three. And in fact, at this stage, nobody was quite sure what his first language was, which I did pick them up on, and actually that they needed to go and find out what his first language was. But there had been some confusion over his arrival and his settling. And dad would bring him to nursery. And as far as this child was concerned, he was extremely miffed. You know, this was not a place he wanted to be. And he certainly did not see why his dad had to leave him there. And he had really only one choice, which was to scream very loudly and to shout and to cry. A little bit of feet stamping, but mostly he was just extremely distressed. I suggested that this practitioner who was trying to engage him and trying to distract him, and she knew he liked the small world animals, so she had these out, and he was having none of it, really. And she was talking, you know, constantly, you know, encouraging him and comforting him and all the rest of it. And I just kind of went, you know, stop talking. Sorry, I'll say that again a bit louder. Stop talking was what I said, but I whispered it to her. And she looked at me, you know, cut the gabble. And we had talked about this a little bit beforehand. And bless her, she tried. And it was difficult. It was you could see it was really difficult. And of course it is. As practitioners, we are encouraged to talk constantly at children, to grow their vocabulary, to be constantly engaging them in language and discussion and questions and all the rest of it. So it's really difficult to suddenly go, actually stop talking. And it's really quite difficult to stop talking to a child who is distressed as well. But as my child once said to me when I was saying, it's okay, he went, it's not okay. And I thought, yeah, you're right, actually. And so we have to think very carefully about, you know, it's okay to shush, you know, use comforting sounds. But actually, sometimes the talk is just too much. In this instance, once she got used to the idea of not talking, and she began to play with the animals. And then again, I suggested then that she mirror what he was doing with the animals. So not to play with him, not to lead the play, not to take the play anywhere, but just to mirror. And again, she found this quite difficult to begin with, because we are so used, aren't we, to thinking we must take it further forward. We must move it on. You know, oh, is the giraffe lying down? You know, okay, so she'd learned not to say anything, but then she was manipulating the giraffe to try and communicate something to the child. And it's like, no, just do exactly what the child is doing. Mirror the child's movements. And these were very tiny movements, a lot of fine motor control to manipulate this little giraffe. And it was almost as the child was attempting to distract himself. He was still crying quietly to himself. And anyway, at some point, the magic happened. And it did feel like magic, I have to say, to observe it. But the practitioner really got it. And she began to mirror the tiny little movements that the child was making with his giraffe with her animal. And at some point, where the magic really happened was when the child noticed this. And he noticed that she had noticed him and that she was really paying attention to him. And very slowly, gradually, the crying stopped. His breathing slowed down, and so did her breathing slow down. The tension in his body dissipated. The tension in her body dissipated. And the two of them spent ages just moving these animals around. And eventually, a little bit of connection. The animals were connecting. Yeah. Now, the next day, I wasn't there, but I was told that the child came in. Yes, he was distressed, and he went straight for this practitioner. She was the one he was now prepared to allow to comfort him. The following week, he would still make for her every morning, but he was actually coming into nursery a lot happier. So, you know, the happy ever after story, the happy ending. But for me, that was evidence of a practitioner's bravery to try something out of their comfort zone, which sounds easy. And in fact, to somebody observing, looks like they're not even doing their job properly. It was quite the opposite. And the connection was what made all the difference to that child. And that, I think, is what it's all about.
It is. And it's that child having somebody coming into their world, isn't it? That adult has stepped into their world. They can see where that child is, where that child's coming from. And I think it's really nice that you've touched on that, because actually, you know, we do have a lot of English as an additional language children in Norfolk. And actually, it's reminding staff that actually, like you said, we went through that whole bit about questioning. Now it's commenting and one question. And actually, it's having that bravery as a practitioner to step back and be able to just observe the child and just see what they're doing and how you can mirror that. And that's a really, like you said, it's a difficult thing to do. But once you're able to do it, it means so much to that child.
Yeah.
And it's having that nonverbal communication with that child. It's still a form of communication, but you're communicating in their way. So it's really good to hear that that's happening.
And it becomes another thing in your kit bag, your toolbox of things. So it's not that you never talk again to a child. It's not that you never lead the play again. It's another thing that you've got in your tool bag to be able to draw on when it seems appropriate. And it's so much about observing and knowing that child. And it allows you to observe them better. And it's good for all our children. And what it does, certainly for a child with EAL or a child with SEND or a shy child, it takes the burden of talk off them. You know, children know that they're expected to reply, to answer questions, to engage with us. And if for some children, you take away that burden, that obligation, actually, you remove a whole load of stress from them. You take away children's stress, you're actually able to get, you know, the child is going to wallow in that stress-free environment or stress-less environment and actually be able to move forward.
Anne, I wanted to jump topics slightly, if that's okay with you. And I wanted to talk about that kind of age-old concern, really, that physical play, particularly that rough and tumble play and the big gross motor skill play, like climbing and balancing and hanging upside down and jumping off things could result in someone getting hurt. I think that can be a bit of a worry for practitioners sometimes. So I was wondering what you would say to those practitioners who are worried about injuries and who have perhaps become a little bit more risk averse in their choices of activities.
People are worried about it. We've become a risk averse society. There's also very good reasons why we have health and safety policies. You know, there are children who are alive today because of health and safety policies. And then we have to work out, now, hang on a minute, what are the principles? What are the non-negotiables here? And the non-negotiable for me is that children need to grow to learn how to do their own risk assessment. And then we'll only do that by being exposed to challenge, so let's call it challenge in this context, that enables them to find out how to manage and also how to make decisions for themselves about what's a real risk, what's a danger, what they're prepared to have a go at, what they're not quite ready for yet. So if all your life you've only ever experienced falling off something onto rubber crumb, you don't know what it feels like to land on concrete or a paving slab or grass or a muddy puddle. You actually have to feel those experiences to learn how to manage your body, and particularly with regards to proprioception and the fact that our bodies are constantly changing as you get older and the body matures. You need to be able to know how to manage that risk. You need to be able to weigh up something and go, yeah, I'm ready to give that a go. Or say, please, can you help me? I'm stuck at the top of the climbing frame and I don't think I can get down by myself. And then that comes down to us being able to go, okay, how am I going to help this child in a way that actually takes them to where, you know, it's classic Vygotsky scaffolding zone of proximal development. You've got a child stuck at the top of the climbing frame, you know, like the kitten up the chimney, they manage to get there, but they can't find their way down. So the simplest thing is to lift them off and put them down. And if they're terrified and they need to be down straight away, well, of course you'll do that. But actually, if this is a learning moment and it feels the right time, you're going to stand close behind that child. You're going to help them slide their hands up, to be able to grip, but to slide their hands slowly down if it's a ladder or whatever. To be able to stretch out one leg and one toe and one foot, you might even help them find the next run of the ladder. But you're there, you're behind them. They know it's safe. And if their bodies will be telling you, as well as their voices maybe, yeah, I'm prepared to give this a go. It's scary, but I know I'll be okay.
Do you think it's almost inevitable that risk has to go hand in hand with physical play?
Yes, I suppose. Because actually, the minute you get up off the floor, you're taking a risk, aren't you?
Yeah.
Just think of what it, perhaps it's just as well that we don't think, but, you know, a baby who has just learnt to walk, what risks are they taking, you know, just to get across the floor, you know, risking that thump as they land on their bottoms, usually covered in a nappy, so it's a little bit softer. And yeah, they haven't got that far to go, but it's it's a shock. And actually, some children learn to enjoy that experience of putting themselves at risk. You know, I watched my little great niece recently. I bought her a wobble board for Christmas. I don't know if you know what I mean. So it looks like a little wooden arch.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And you can stand on it and wobble. Actually, what she likes to do is to turn it over, because they're multi-purpose, these things. And she likes to stand at the top and then slide down and inevitably falls down and lands on her bottom. And she does that over and over again, because falling, actually, the fear and the management of it feels good. So actually, the feel good is giving her the payback that says, I'm going to do this, so that eventually, actually, it won't be a risk for her because she can manage it very well. But also the emotional sense of, I know what I can do now. So I think we have to find ways of being able to do that. It doesn't mean we absolve ourselves of all responsibility, because we still have to look out for hazards. And it's about knowing the difference between a hazard and a risk. And a hazard is something that gets in the way of us being safe to do what we need to do. It shouldn't be there effectively.
Yeah.
So, you know, a rucked up carpet or a nail sticking out of something. That's not a risk, that's a hazard. It's our responsibility to check our outdoor spaces every morning to make sure there are no new hazards there. A risk is something that can be part of our play. And it's something that we can bring into our play. You know, someone else can put it there, but very often it's when a child brings that risk in themselves, they are actually stretching themselves. And sometimes they will say, I want to do this, but I need you to help me with it.
Yeah.
And that's our role there.
I think it's really interesting what you were saying there about the child bringing in the risk sometimes, that kind of risk element, that it's almost like they are much more risk tolerant than us as adults, and they want to explore and they want to try new things, even if that does mean, you know, falling off and bumping their knee, cracking their head, you know, whatever that might be. And it got me thinking a little bit about those behaviours that we sometimes see in settings that at first glance, you might think look challenge like a challenging behaviour, something that's unwanted that we'd rather they weren't doing. But actually, from the child's perspective, they're just playing and they're just exploring and wanting to learn and to try new things. And I think very closely related to that is that repetitive schematic play, isn't it? Like I was talking about my own experiences with my daughter earlier, you know, the constant spinning, the constant climbing as well and hiding, those kind of things. If I was a practitioner experiencing perhaps within my setting lots of different schematic play going on, some that is more easy to, I want to say, manage with air quotes, but also some that is more challenging when you've only got maybe one or two pairs of hands and children wanting to jump from different objects and do all of those things. What kind of advice would you give them really for I guess, A, identifying schematic behaviour? And perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about that and, you know, why that's so developmentally important. But also how practitioners can channel that in a safe and positive way.
Yeah, good question. my kind of understanding of schemas, and I might, this isn't an in-depth understanding, by the way, but simplistically, is that children use schemas to make sense of the world, really. And because it's giving them more and more information about the wider world and how they, you know, how they might connect these schemas to the wider world, they are getting information from it. And so they're going to want to keep doing it. And sometimes that is about refining it, repeating an action in order to refine to get better at doing something. And sometimes it is just because it's giving them more and more information about themselves and about the way the world works. And obviously there are lots of, classifications of schemas. And, it can be really interesting to be plotting those and to be recognizing them. I think the tie-in there for me with children's physical behaviors that may be linked to their schema, they may be linked to their biological drive that they have to develop and refine something or to gain automatic mastery or for a sensory stimulation, is about the child's recognizing that there's a drive there. Recognizing, in the first instance, the child is not doing this in order to annoy us. It will feel sometimes like they're doing it to annoy us, but actually that's not what it's about. And that's our work, is to do that thing for ourselves, which goes, okay, this isn't about me. This isn't about that child being annoying. And recognizing that, because you probably already told them twice, three times, four times not to do it, but they're still doing it. Okay, that is telling you something. You know, that drive, that urge is there. Then you're trying to work out why. And very rarely is it in order to annoy us. Very, very, very rarely is it for that, if ever, I would say. But that's a whole other discussion. Part of that awareness and understanding is actually about skilling ourselves up in things like physical development. Being able to recognize the kinds of behaviors that children do in order to build their proprioception, to build their vestibular system. So that actually to be able to recognize, as you said, your little one spinning, okay, you know where that's coming from now. And actually in that context, you can then use it and you can use it in helpful ways for the child. Now, that still doesn't take into account when a child is doing something that actually is great for them, but maybe isn't great for everybody else. Yeah. Sometimes we also have to kind of go, well, actually, is it just because when I'm reading a story, it's easier on my brain and my eyes and my general stress levels if everyone is sitting still with their legs crossed? Sometimes we also need to go, well, actually, is sitting still on the floor with our legs crossed the only way to really listen to a story? And actually, have I got some work to do here about how I can manage to tell a story and how maybe I use more of my body than I have done previously in order to be able to respond and mirror what the children are giving me when they're moving? Because very often children are driven by a story to want to move. You know, they're already acting it out, aren't they? But also some children will be thinking, well, actually, if I hung upside down off the sofa to listen to this story, my brain feels a lot calmer. And that actually feels quite good. Of course, you can't have 15 children all hanging upside down off the sofa, can you? I get that. But it's also about recognizing, well, that if it's okay to let one person get comfortable in the way that suits them, you can actually let everyone get comfortable. So maybe some people prefer to lie on their tummies. Some people prefer to kneel up. Some children will need to move every 3 seconds because their bodies, you know, actually that's how, you know, that's linked to their development of proprioception and the muscles and the tendons, because actually the body is triggered and stimulated to move every few seconds in a child. That is science, you know. Once we start to look at things a little bit differently, we reframe things. We have a little bit of a mind shift. I'm not saying that every story has to be a free-for-all. I'm just saying we open up to that. But also, if what we're seeing are children who are clearly sensory seeking by these actions, then maybe we need to find ways of filling up their sensory cup in advance of things like a story time, perhaps. So that means that a child who is always spinning or twizzling when they, you know, when it's carpet time, what are we doing for them outdoors where it's much safer for them to engage in the kind of risky or, you know, energetic or vigorous kind of behavior they seem to be telling us they need? If we think of the senses, everybody has these cups, you know, and you've got a certain amount of sensory stimulation has to be in there. And for some children, there's a leak in the bottom, so their cup never gets filled. And some children, there's only a little bit of a dripping tap and, you know, the whole thing overflows. So it's about finding ways of proactively responding to those sensory needs so that at other times children won't have that same drive, that same urge, won't overwhelm everything else. Does that sort of make sense?
I think it's really interesting what you said about being reflective of your own practice as well, and actually thinking about why are you asking the children to do what you're asking them to do? Is there a real purpose behind that, or is it actually just, as you said, to make your...
everyone thinks we're supposed to do.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and I think when you've probably been in your profession for a long time, you just probably do get used to doing the things in a certain way because that's how they've always been done. But there's certainly room for wider thinking a lot of the time. And that's a really useful point for practitioners to take away, I think.
And that is to say, you know, I totally understand the limitations and the difficulties of, you know, lots of children and not enough staff and not enough space and not enough time and all of those things. I totally get it. You know, I have been there. I have worn that T-shirt, but I know it's even worse now. And I know there are so many things that are weighing heavily on practitioners. So, you know, my hat goes off to you all, you know, and again, you know, always thanks for how you kept the world going during COVID. And I'm, you know, I will hark back on that, but you did, guys. So, you know,
absolutely.
I think that's really important.
Definitely. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Anne. We're almost at the end of our podcast. We've talked about such a wide variety of things, such a lot of positive things. And we really appreciate you joining us today on our first episode of Let's Talk series. And I know I have thoroughly enjoyed learning more about how physical development is so sort of interconnected and intertwined with all those other areas of development as well. And it's been really interesting to listen to. So thank you once again. And we really hope that everyone listening to the podcast at home has enjoyed this conversation and that they've learned something new or gained a new insight that they can then share with their colleagues. But before we round off this podcast, we'd really like to start a closing tradition whereby we ask our guest speaker to leave three questions or to pose three questions to our Norfolk Early Years practitioners to think about between now and our follow-up face-to-face meetings that we'll have for the communication hubs. And these questions are designed to initiate some really reflective conversations between peers and promote some really meaningful discussions at the face-to-face meetings. So, Anne, what three questions would you like to encourage our early years providers to think about?
Ooh, what a lovely idea. So the first one would be, how do you feel about talking gobbledygook with children? Gobbledygook being shorthand for babbling or making sounds that aren't necessarily words, but are hugely important in the development of speech and language, and how you can link those with movement. So, say, for example, I think we've kind of touched on some of these things, but, you know, you're lifting a little one up off the floor and you go, whoop, 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 and then you put them down on the floor and you go, down, 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 down. So actually using sounds and babbles and all of those important things that are part of that whole process of beginning language, integrating them with movement, particularly with babies, but not exclusively, actually, because I think 3 and 4 year olds love to play with sounds. And, you know, we could spend a lot of time talking about phonics and all the rest of it, but actually playing with sound is a really, for me, a vital part of how we learn what we can do with our voices. And bearing in mind that many of our children will have sounds in their languages that aren't necessarily in yours. So, you know, play around with that as well. What other languages can you find out about and the sounds that you can experiment and play with and link it with movement? The second one would be, how do you feel about dizzy play? And actually, I do mean, how do you feel? How does it make you feel physically? Is it something that when you watch children engaging in dizzy play, and I would hope now you'd see why they do it and how it fits in terms of physical development. What is your instinct? Do you feel that you need to tell them to be careful or to stop because they're going to make themselves dizzy? Point of information here, that's why they're doing it and that's why they need to do it. But it's fair to ask yourself first how you feel about it, because it is okay if it makes you feel uncomfortable. It's not, you know, it's not that you mustn't acknowledge how it makes you feel. If it makes you feel uncomfortable, it might make you feel queasy. It might make you feel as though you see an accident just about to happen. Have it, reflect on how it makes you feel, and then have a reflection. Now you know there's a whole lot more to dizzy play, and that's just one way of describing it. There's lots of other more technical ways we could describe it. Now you know how important it is. How are you going to manage how you feel about it? And that might be a very justifiable and valid feeling, and how you're actually going to encourage it in your setting. And the final one would be, how do you feel about buttoning your lip now and again? Not all the time. Just now and again, how does it feel when you actually get yourself to not talk and to think about the quantity of talk as well as the quality of talk that you have? Sometimes two good words are better than a whole paragraph of chatter. See how you feel about that.
Oh, wow. Perfect, Anne. They are brilliant questions. And I really think they're going to give our practitioners a real food for thought and really make them think. And, you know, they can have those discussions in their staff meetings, back at their settings. But it's also going to be really great to revisit those questions at our face-to-face communication hub meetings. And I think we're going to hear some interesting comments coming from our practitioners when they talk about those three questions.
Well, I think that draws us nicely to a close. So thank you again, Anne, for joining us. It was a really an enlightening conversation. So, you know, thank you again. We really enjoyed that. And hopefully our practitioners will too.
Yes. Hello to everybody in Norfolk and good luck with your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. We'd like to remind everybody that as part of our new Communication Hub format, This podcast will be followed up with a face-to-face session in your local area, and these start from March the 18th. If you have any questions or any feedback on this podcast that you'd like to let us know about, please contact myself or Ashley on communication and language EY at norfolk.gov.uk.